Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. What challenges and crises are the sudden death of Iran's president and his succession revealing? What's happening inside Iran? And what's happening with Iran internationally? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. On May 19, 2024, Iran's president died in a helicopter crash. The nation's foreign minister and seven other ministers died as well. In the midst of this political crisis, where new leadership needs to be chosen, Iran faces numerous challenges and crises. Domestically, protests have arisen throughout the nation following the state murder of Mahsa Amini. These protests highlight the treatment of women under the state. Iran is also a very young country, but it has an aging leadership. Economic challenges, particularly for the younger population, persist. And internationally, Iran is locked in a political battle over leadership in the Islamic world with rival Saudi Arabia, as well as ongoing conflicts with Western interests led by the United States for Iran's support of resistance groups. So on today's show, we will explore what this acute political crisis about political leadership might indicate and signal about the future of this incredibly important nation of Iran. Our panel today is Zavish Ranjbar Daimi. He is a lecturer in Modern Middle East History, School of History at the University of St. Andrews. He's the author of The Tudeh Party of Iran and the Peasant Question, and The Quest for Authority, A History of the Presidency from Revolution to Rouhani. Saeed Golkar, associate professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. He's the author of Captive Society, The Bajiv Mobilization and Social Control in Post-Revolutionary Iran, and Personalization of Power in Iran, Regime Incompetency and Protests in Iran. Nayarat Tohidi is Professor Emerita in the Department of Gender and Women's Studies and Middle East and Islamic Studies at California State University, Northridge. She's the author of Women's Rights and Feminist Movements in Iran. And Ervand Abrahamian is Professor Emeritus at the City University of New York. He's the author of A History of Modern Iran and Inventing the Axis of Evil, The Truth About North Korea, Iran, and Syria. So thank you all very, very much for joining us. And Ervand Abrahamian, we know that this helicopter crash, that's what's really captured a lot of the headlines and gotten a lot of attention on Iran right now. What's happened since that crash? And just how significant is this, a political crisis, or is this just a challenge of choosing a new president?
Iran has a lot of problems, longstanding problems, but the actual elimination of the president doesn't have much significance, mainly because Iran is such a institutionalized, the constitution is such entrenched that, you know, all the parts are set up there so that when one person is eliminated, either by assassination or accident or death, there is a setup bureaucrat. Max Weber would have been very impressed by the institutionalization of power. So I think the replacement is not a problem. Where there is an internal problem is, of course, Raisi was being groomed to succeed the leader, the supreme leader, and they'll have to find someone else to do it. And that might cause internal rivalries. But short of that, actually, the death of the president has no significance because the president himself didn't have much significance. And the main decisions are really made by the National Security Council and finally by the leader at the top. So one person, even foreign minister, president, are not that significant.
Zavish Ranjbar Daimi, I know you've written about the presidency in Iran. So let's delve into this a little bit further. What exactly is the role the president plays vis-a-vis the so-called supreme leader, the clerics, et cetera? How much does it matter who the president is?
Well, it's a very good question. The Iranian presidency is a bit of an anomalous institution, if we want. The origins are with the presidency as envisaged in the French Fifth Republic. And that's still the way in which Iranian presidents are elected, pretty much. And, single nationwide election without an electoral college or any other mechanism like that. However, the Iranian president certainly is the most powerful authority of the land. he is subordinate to a whole range of other institutions, from the supreme leader to National Security Council to elected and non-elected clerics. I think the way in which we can envisage the president is that of being a sort of a promoter of a specific set of policies and of ambitions that each of these candidates has from the moment they register at the Interior Ministry to the moment that somebody wins these elections. Obviously, the range of candidates that can run for presidency, and therefore the president himself, is really whittled down by this filtering mechanism of the Guardian Council, which is very stringent and at times very difficult even to comprehend. But as we have seen, different presidents have advocated very different positions on key policies. And in some way, they have influenced decision-making at higher levels. So, for example, a decade ago, when President Rouhani was in charge, you saw that we had the most significant set of negotiations between Iran and the West. That unraveled as the nuclear deal unraveled. And during the presidency of Raisi in the last 2 years, we saw nothing of that. And we saw a very significant entrenchment of Iran along the lines of what the Supreme Leader Khamenei sort of posited in terms of animosity with the West. It is also important to know that presidencies usually start off by being very ambitious characters with very ambitious programs, but then they're really worn out by this long war of attrition they have, often with the Supreme Leader and with other institutions. So much to the point that former Iranian presidents are rather tired and spent figures at the end of their presidencies, with the exception of one of them, which I would argue is Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, who is one of the most active politicians in the land to this day. However, it is, as I said, a peculiar institution, and it is one which captures the attention both inside and outside the country, because it's also one of the most visible elements of the Iranian state system. It's one which is constantly in the sphere of public attention and so on and so forth. But of course, in the last 3 years, the whole institution of the presidency was weakened by the way Raisi took up his powers. And by the way, it has become less and less significant in the very important policies of the Islamic Republic. When it comes to the Islamic Republic's regional policies, when it comes to the role of bodies such as the IRGC, when it comes to, of course, relations with the West, these were all remits in which one didn't really feel that President Raisi had a major role.
Mary Tahiti, I know the way in which it was reported after the helicopter crash was that Raisi had been a pretty strict authoritarian president. You know, human rights records certainly been called into question. And immediately when we think of human rights in Iran, in particular in the last and very recent history, the role of the protests around the murder of Mahsa Amini and demands for greater recognition for women's rights immediately come into play. So the question, first of all, how important is whoever's chosen as president on this larger issue about human rights? And then also a bit of an update on what's been going on with the protests.
Before I answer that question, I like to say that about this power structure in Iran, as Dr. Daimi mentioned, about the peculiarity of it, which is not really a republic. And at least it had the republican element of the state power and of these state institutions have been diminished increasingly, especially after the last presidential election. An election of Raisi has been the most engineered and obviously manipulated elections, and with the lowest turnout because of his very negative and bloody image that he had already because of his role in mass executions of the prisoners, political prisoners who were spending their time, and many of them, they were supposed to be released soon, but they were tried very short trials by a committee of four people or maybe five people. And Raisi was one of them. So he has been known as Ayatollah Qatil, meaning murderer Ayatollah. So that was one of the reasons why people didn't turn out for the elections, because they knew that Raisi is the one. Even some of the hardliners that were part of the supporters of the, you know, the Supreme Leader and Velayat-e Faqih, the supreme authority of the jurists, they were also disqualified from the elections. I mean, the legitimacy of the regime, not only because of the repression, and especially during the different uprisings we saw in the latest years, but also because of the people who were engineered to come out of the ballot box, has been damaged profoundly. So much that even someone like Khatami, former president, relatively liberal and popular president, declared that he was not going to participate in elections because it has lost its meaning and the ballot box is not working any longer. So I think it's important to say that, because even now there are conspiracy theories that Raisi was, I mean, this was not just an accident. It was, engineered by those who thought that Raisi was so incompetent and was failing in and adding to the increasing illegitimacy and the chasm between the majority of people and the government. So they wanted to get rid of him. But who wanted exactly to get rid of him? We don't know. So one issue is that still it is not completely clear. There are, even in a newspaper like Cumhuriyet Islami, very conservative hardline newspaper, who are asking and questioning about this so-called accident. They don't believe that this was just an accident. So that is one element which is left there. But now going back to your question about what's the significance of it with regard to human rights, the reality is that Khamenei is for continuation and not change, not even any retreat or concession to the reformists or to people, because he believes that he has learned this lesson from the Shah's mistake not to retreat, not to show any flexibility, because that will embolden people inside Iran and the enemies outside Iran. So that is his approach. But we are seeing some signs, maybe because things are so bad and crisis, as Gramsci puts it, is organically comprehensive in all areas, economic, political, cultural, ideological failure of the regime and corruption and failure in the foreign policy, regional policy, all that. For 45 years, they have been calling for death of America, death of Saudi Arabia, death of Israel, death of France, death of England, United Kingdom, and all that. But now they see that even when Israel and Hamas war started, Iranian regime kind of stood away and didn't do much. And Arabs got very angry, especially Arab streets, that they didn't support much in this war. They were not actively involved. Therefore, there are some signs just starting in the past few days that in the parliamentary elections in Majlis, the Paydari Front, that is the resistance front, which is the Hojatiye, goes back to Hojatiye Association, that is very hardliner group of Islamists, they got defeated and Ghalibaf became the speaker of the parliament. And this is after a very hard rivalry, because the Paydari Front represents people like Jalili and people like Raisi and Misbah, Ayatollah Misbah. So this is one sign, because this couldn't have happened without the green sign from the Rahbar. The other sign we are seeing is that Ali Larijani is going to, you know, run for presidency. And what he said, the promises he made, and Ali Jani, for those who may not know him, is close to Rouhani. And remember that Rouhani has been threatened to be tried and even executed, like many other presidents. You know, they have very bad fate after their presidency. Except that Ahmadinejad, as Professor Abrahamian mentioned, is still very, or somebody else, I can't remember, is still very active and resisting some of the other fates that happened to other presidents. So the running of Larijani, who was not qualified last time when he tried to run, is important sign. And also there was a meeting between 31 parties of reformers, Islah Talaban. They decided, including Khatami, who had said he's not gonna participate in elections and the ballot box has failed, they decided to present candidates for the presidential elections. So again, this means that they have received some permission from the... Now, what does this mean for human rights? Not much. We don't know, sure. Again, because president doesn't have much power. So but cool. There are signs that maybe Khamenei is showing some flexibility.
And we'll circle back to that. And you're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. On today's show, we're discussing the politics in Iran and the crisis, the political succession crisis as a result of the death of its president in a helicopter crash. Our guests today are Saibash Ranjbar Naimi of the University of St. Andrews, Saeed Golkar of the University of Texas at Chattanooga, Nayari Tohidi of California State University Northridge, and Irvan Abrahamian of City University of New York. And Saeed Golkar, I want to bring you in to the conversation. First of all, it sounds like from what we've been talking about, there's the potential for some changes, some sort of openings. So I guess the simple question is, how much is this business as usual? How much can we actually look at the possibility that there could be some changes?
Thank you for having me. Actually, I'm not very optimistic about any kind of the change in Islamic Republic. You know, we have to distinguish between two different issues, what we call the everyday politics, you know, the discussion and the differences between the individual and then, like, for example, President Raisi and his rivals, and something we call it the political, the discourse of the Islamic Republic. It's a bigger, you know, issues. I have argued that Ayatollah Khamenei, since 2019, gradually has changed the Islamic Republic from a more hybrid, you know, competitive authoritarian regime to the more personalistic system. You know, he's gradually personalized the IRGC, Revolutionary Guard. He personalized the clergy and seminary school. And the later one, he personalized a state bureaucracy, especially after the Ayatollah Raisi came to the power in 2021. He tried first under the Ahmadinejad, was not successful. What we've seen in Iran after 2021 is a very different animal. This is a personalistic system that Ayatollah Khamenei has absolute power. I'm not denying that in the political aspect, everyday politics, there is a competition between IRGC, some seminary, and some political faction. But in a bigger sense, you know, this is a personalistic system. And what does it mean? It means, you know, the personalistic system is one of the most corrupted among of the other authoritarian regime, one-party system, military system, or, you know, a different authoritarian regime. Personalist system, because of the nature that the dictator tried to personalize, became one of the most corrupted system. We have this situation right now. Raisi is out of the picture, and Ayatollah Khamenei has a hectic time to find somebody that, you know, check all of the boxes that the Ayatollah Raisi had, the same loyalty, the same, you know, political outlook, the same yes man without, you know, challenging him, like Ahmadinejad, for example. Until now, 9 people have been registered, and I'm sure by the next 2 days, we will see other people who will run. First, the Guardian Council should, you know, review their qualification, and like every other election, we will have manipulated, engineered election that the Guardian Council will let a few people run. And then the second part of the story is other institutions trying to push their own agenda. You know, I really believe for Ayatollah Khamenei point of view, somebody like Raisi is a good president, you know, again, as yes man, without any personality, without too much ambition, somebody like a rubber stamper for his office and his himself. So right now we are in this position to find the next president. But who will come to the power is not very important. All of the discussion will be in the level of the politics, everyday politics, not the political discourse that Ayatollah Khamenei is pushing it, both regionally and domestically. You know, Ayatollah Khamenei has a manifestation, very important one, that unfortunately we didn't really study it or pay attention. He came to the power as a leader. His manifestation is, we are in the path of the five stage of the revolution, 1979 Islamic revolution, 1982 consolidation of power, but we are stuck in creation of Islamic governance or Islamic administration. What Ayatollah Khamenei tried to did with Ahmadinejad was not successful, and with Ayatollah Raisi in 2021. But there is two stage left, Islamization of society and creation of Islamic civilization or Islamic global order. Khamenei will find somebody to put it in this position, hopefully will push and complete this project. And I really don't think that change will come from the top.
And Professor Abrahamian, you started off talking about how Raisi, maybe the death of Raisi was most significant because he was being positioned to replace the current Khatami, the current Ayatollah, the current, you know, head, is actually quite old, right? And there's an expectation that there's going to need to be some sort of transfer of power relatively soon. So how much is, that's ultimately the question. And all of the clerics, from my understanding, are pretty old, are pretty aged. So is there a new generation that's going to replace them? And could you expect any sort of change in governance with the new generation?
Well, you're right. They're old, but Ayatollahs tend to live to a ripe old age. So the present leader, I think, is 85. He has some medical problems. So I think, again, the people at the core are pretty rational and calculating. They've been thinking about who to replace him in the way they've thought about who to replace Khomeini. It didn't always work out right because the person who was groomed then actually turned out to be a problem. But I think they had already been thinking about who would be the best replacement for Khomeini. And clearly, Raisi was being groomed for that. He was cleric. He was hard enough. He was not someone who was going to change policies and therefore disrupt the inner core of the establishment. I think that's going to be a problem in the short run in terms of if Khamenei dies in the near future. But again, they have a setup. They have an institution already of grand old men who will decide who to succeed. I think they could easily find someone who's a fairly non-entity as a figurehead. Because I think that behind the institutions, there is a core. It's equivalent to a sort of a military industrial complex. It's more like a hostile military, bazaar, commercial monopoly complex. And they will determine who would be a good person to actually lead their so-called Islamic Republic.
Professor Golkar, I'm going to turn to you then, because since you've written quite a bit about social control, what we're hearing in the West is that there's definitely these cracks of social control. I mean, there's no doubt the state is autocratic as well as theocratic, but we keep hearing more and more about protest movements. As I've read, Iran has a long history of protest movements, so it's not like this is something new. But is it fair to say there's a inherent tension between the autocratic state, these protest movements, demanding at least some sort of space, some freedom for political expression? Or is that a case of wishful thinking on my part?
You're completely right in both cases. You know, Iran has a long history of protest movement. Some scholar called Iran as a revolutionary country. Like Russia, it has only two, countries with the two big revolution in 20 centuries. And even if you look at the Iran from 1979 to now, they have been a lot of protests. Some scholar called Iran as a movement society, very shaky societies, especially from 1919. We have a lot of small protests that gradually are becoming much more radical and much more frequent and much more, aggressive from 1991 to 1993, 1999, 2003, 2009, and 2017, 18, 19, 22. So that's a long history of the protest. It shows two things. You know, like all every authoritarian regime, there is a gap between a state and society. You know, that's the nature of the authoritarian regime. And that's why the authoritarian regime try to keep the power mostly through the naked force. Or, you know, if they are much more wiser, like China or Russia, they will bring more cooptation and legitimization of the system. Islamic Republic, 43 years after its creation, has lost its legitimacy in the eyes of the Iranian people, most of the Iranian people. Every country, every regime has a social basis. But most of the Iranian really don't believe to the legitimacy of the system that come from two sources, from the theocratic sources, from the theological sources, that Ayatollah Khamenei is the representative of the hidden imam, is the velayat-e faqih, is the guardianship of the juries, and all of this Islamic component. And from the Republican side, that has been, as Dr. Toidi said, under the attack since, you know, 2009 at least. So that's a legitimacy. Because of what I call dumbification of a state, because of the Ayatollah Khamenei trying to bring more ideological, loyal people to the state bureaucracy, it gradually became incompetent. They are not effective as other states, like China, for example, in this case. They are not able to provide, you know, what they have promised to the Iranian. So this economic situation are getting very bad. Environmental, you know, problem Iran has for a long time. There are a lot of structural causes. Politically, Iran is one of the most repressive systems. Culturally, socially, Iran is very similar to the what we call the proto-totalitarian, because even, you know, your clothing, your personal life is under control of the state. Economically, we are dealing with one of the most, you know, high inflation, unemployment. So put all of this a structural cause, you have a society that is not satisfied, is really angry, is really alienated from the system. And you have a very repressive system who right now relies only on naked repression, mostly naked repression. This is not equilibrium that can survive for a long term. The protests will come again, because unless the Islamic Republic find a solution to solve this cause, the problem will be there. So the people are angry and you know, are not happy. The only solution or the only possible way, if the Islamic Republic lost its desire or capacity to repress, that I don't think it's happening right now. That's unfortunate that the state is not able to solve the problem and at the same time is a repressive. So this kind of the social political repression will continue until one of these, until the society became happier with the state, or the state lose its power to repress?
Yes, Professor Abrahamian, you have a response.
Yes, I'd like to add to that. This is the long-term problem for the regime, is that the discourse, the language of the regime is completely divorced and separate from the language of the increasing population. People in the street, people, average people, even people who are religious, are talking in the language of equality, liberty, natural rights. And the state is really talking about, we represent God, what we say is the word of God. So there's no sort of way of being able to compromise or come to a sort of medium account. It's, I think, in a way, it's a much more serious problem than it had before in the history of Iran. Because before, at least, people could agree on fundamentals. Here, there's a completely divorced. And that's why I don't think the regime can afford to even loosen up. Because if it does that, automatically the language of the opposition is not something it can deal with. To use a sort of Foucaultian terminology, it's a crisis of discourse. There are two different discourses at the present time. And that's why, for the public, there's no legitimacy in the regime.
Sevish Ranjbar Naimi, you had some thoughts as well.
Yes, to add on these very valid points, we shouldn't forget that the Islamic Republic is a very experiential state system as well. And the experience here is the revolution, the war against Iraq of the 1980s, the period of Khomeini. And it is, as we mentioned, rather resistant to generational change. So if you look at the roster of people who signed up for running in the past couple of days of registrations, today we had Ali Larijani, who was a first candidate 19 years ago. Then, of course, Saeed Jalili, who has been on the political scene since 2005 and ran a couple of times. None of the candidates so far is really new. They are people who have been within the system in one role or the other for the past 30-odd years, even 40-odd years. And you contrast this with a society which is getting younger and younger, and more the majority of society are people who have never seen Khomeini, who have never seen revolution, who have never even witnessed the war, who were born actually in the Khatami period, which was this period of relative openness or the reformist experiment. So they don't even have any memory of that. All they have memory of is the Ahmadinejad period, the Rouhani interlude, and then the Raisi period. So various levels of crisis. And of course, this is a generation which is very literate, which is growing up importantly with relatives, at least every single Iranian middle-class family now has relatives in the West. And they have connection with the West, which is personal, which goes beyond social media, beyond internet, beyond watching the West on any satellite or domestic television channel. It is direct based on the fact that because of the brain drain and because of migration, increasing amounts, virtually any Iranian family has relatives in every generation in the West. So this dissonance is a very serious one, which is being addressed by some of the people who have signed up to run, and at least at face value, they are trying to admit that there is a problem of an alienation between state and society that needs to be in some way addressed. But again, the big problem is these people are not new faces. These people have long, especially somebody like Alila Arjani, have long really gravitated within the various spheres of the regime, at times engaging in suppression of cultural diversity as culture minister as head of radio television. And what he wants to do, for example, with regards to the hijab problem, which, as we know, is an explosive problem now and hasn't been solved and hasn't gone away, despite the attempts to suppress the Women Life Freedom Movement, is an open question, really.
When we come back, given Iran's domestic challenges, will the country look internationally to shore up support for the regime? Stay with us. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. How much of Iran's foreign policy is driven by domestic issues? And how much of it is a reaction to external actors, most notably the United States? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Our guests today are Siavush Ranjbar Naimi. He's a lecturer in modern Middle Eastern history at the University of St. Andrews. Saeed Golkar, who is an associate professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Tennessee, Chattanooga. Nairi Tohidi, who is professor emerita in the departments of Gender and Women's Studies and Middle East and Islamic Studies at California State University, Northridge. And Irvand Abrahamian, who is professor emeritus at City University of New York. So, Professor Abrahamian, I'll ask you this question first. I know that Iran's foreign policy, it's generally been described first and foremost, kind of locked in this battle with Saudi Arabia for leadership in the Islamic world, the Islamic Cold War, we in international relations sometimes will refer to that, and its support for resistance groups, the so-called axis of resistance that have played such a significant role in countries like Yemen, certainly in the occupied territories, et cetera. So how much is Iran using foreign policy to try to rally support domestically, or how much of this, I know this conversation about exporting the revolution, et cetera, what's driving Iran's international decisions?
I don't think the Iranian public is that concerned about foreign relations. It's more concerned about internal politics, a question of liberalization, bread and butter issue. But often the way that in the West it's pictured is that Iran is the active power in foreign policy, that decisions are made in Iran. I would put it the other way. Iran usually reacts to decisions that are made by United States. So I think where Iran is now is not really by choice. It's there because it's been forced there by U.S. policy. So, for instance, Rouhani was not really a reformer or in a way a liberal, but he wanted a better relations with the United States, especially on the nuclear issue. And he got that. But it was, of course, United States that then flushed the agreement down the toilet. And from that point, also, even when that happened, the Iranian government was eager to get Europe involved and have some relations with Europe. And they discovered that Europe didn't have really the independence from the United States. So it really had no choice. Even if you had a real liberal as a president, they would have been forced to basically look towards China and Russia as a way of trying to protect themselves from the United States. And also they're what is called proxies. Again, these are not something that they, I would say, extensively thought out. It's more a way of trying to get some sort of insurance against Israel. But it's not something that's quite obviously going to destroy Israel or solve the Palestinian problem or bring back the Achaemenid or the Sassanid Empire. They're not thinking in those terms. They're basically thinking of survival. And if you can, the only thing you've got is allies, let's say in Iraq or in Syria or in Lebanon, you use them. But they're not Trump cards. They're, I would say, actually pretty weak cards. But they have no choice but to do that.
Professor Tahiti, it's not.
I respectfully disagree with Professor Abrahamian about this, about the foreign policy issue. I quote Javad Zarif, the foreign minister of Iran for years under Rouhani, who in a kind of a direct language had a polemic saying that one of the reason, I mean, the main reason why we are in this situation is because we have decided to go against the West all the time. And this is what we have decided in ma tasmim gerefti, entekhab ma bude. So he correctly gave the agency of this situation, the primary agent of this situation, to Iranians, meaning to those hardliners who started the foreign policy of Iran by hostage taking and then continued crying and shouting Marg Bar Amerika, Marg Bar Israel, elimination of Israel from the map of the world and all that. So we cannot dismiss those realities and blame only the United States policy. Yes, Trump did very wrong thing because at least with the deal that Iran and the US was making, things were going to become better for people and for the possibility of strengthening the power of the middle class and power of the more moderate elements in the power structure in Iran. Unfortunately, Trump actually reinforced the hardliners by just walking away from and tearing down the deal, the nuclear deal. So the Barjam, I mean. So having said that, I think as Professor Abrahamian very well, I mean, said very correctly, I think, that there is a crisis of discourse, but there's also crisis of values and identity between people and the regime. The regime really doesn't believe in millat, nationhood. They're talking about Ummah. They see Syria as part of the extension of Iranian politics, Iranian hegemony, and also other regions, Iraq and so forth. It's because the ideology is based on Ummah, Muslim Ummah, and especially Shia hegemony and rivalry with Sunni hegemony of Saudi Arabia. But while Iranians are very nationalistic, many of them, and look at Iran as a secular, modern, and progressive nation rather than fighting for, they say, نغز نلبنان جانم فدای ایران. That is a very strong statement people made, which shows how they see their identity and their interests, national interests. No Gaza, no Lebanon. I die for Iran. So that is what people in protest say. And that is therefore another chasm between the regime's notion of identity and people's understanding of identity. The movement, the Mahsa movement, Women, Life, Freedom movement, was partly reclaiming Iran. If you look at the musical production of this movement, the slogans they use, they are saying, Mom, Iran ro pas migirim. We want to take back Iran. Iran that they imagine, Iran that they understand. So they see, as Asif Bayat, one of the prominent sociologists of the Middle East and Iran, said, there is now a kind of a dynamic of internal colonization in Iran. People see the regime as colonizers, that they have come to occupy Iran, although they are Iranians, but they see them as occupier because they impose a set of values on Iranians by force. Chador, this cover, is not part of Iranian culture necessarily. It's part of a religious identity some women chose to have or were brainwashed to have. But now that the regime is killing women, even they have to lose their lives because they want to have their own self-body autonomy and their own lifestyle, shows that how much this regime is distant from Iranian people's view and values, not only discourse, but also values and wishes for Iran. So what I see for the prospect is either implosion, gradual implosion, because the regime is losing even his own support, its own supporters. As Mehdi Nassiri says, they see this regime so rotten and corrupt, and they are worried that there is nothing to replace it. Our major concern, especially as the movement, the Mahsa movement showed, is the lack of leadership. We haven't been able to form a leadership that can take over or be an alternative to this regime that can have experience an implosion like the Soviet Union did, rather than explosion as Iran experienced during the 1979 revolution. So who's gonna take over?
And you're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. On today's show, we're discussing the politics in Iran and the crisis, the political succession crisis as a result of the death of its president in a helicopter crash. Our guests today are Sevesh Ranjbar Naimi of the University of St. Andrews, Saeed Golkar of the University of Texas at Chattanooga, Nayari Tohidi of California State University Northridge, and Irvan Abrahamian of City University of New York. And Professor Golkar, you had some thoughts as well.
Thank you. In terms of the Iran foreign policy, Iran regional policy, there has always been discussion to what extent this is ideological policy or based on pragmatism. If you look at signing the nuclear deal, this is a sign of pragmatism. Iran agreed to the 5+1 and signed it. But if you look at, to support of Yemen or the access of resistance of the Islamism around the region, Or if you look at the anti-Americanism of the Iran foreign policy, this is not very rational. You know, Professor Abramian mentioned the nuclear deal, but we shouldn't forget that that was Ayatollah Khamenei. 3 days after the signing, you know, announcing the signing deal, Ayatollah Khamenei asked Rouhani not to talk with Obama anymore, or they threatened that the Javad Zarif will be impeached at the parliament. You know, if you think about anti-Americanism of the Islamic Republic, it doesn't really make sense, you know, in terms of the tactical issues, because, you know, the United States doesn't have problem with a lot of authoritarian regime around the world. So if you want to survive, if you want to, you know, continue your power, you really don't need this anti-Americanism. You can do it much easier, like other authoritarian regime. But if you look at it, the anti-Zionism slash anti-Semitism, anti-Americanism, it's part of this ideological discourse. Again, I put it in Dr. Abramian's idea, Islamic discourse that the Islamic Republic ruler has. You know, inside of this store, they have some tactical, rational, you know, policy. But in terms of the big picture, in terms of the political pictures, they don't want to have any relationship with the United States. The anti-Americanism, anti-Zionism slash, you know, Semitism, that's part of the Islamic Republic DNA, ideology that develop and gradually. And Ayatollah Khamenei, as a supreme leader, as I argue, became the most important political figure, really believed this idea. So in this case, it seems a little bit more ideology in a big picture.
Yes, Professor Abrahamian, I'll give you a chance to respond.
I think the one is we're exaggerating that ideologically. I wouldn't minimize it, but the fact is Islamic Revolution thought when it came to power, it was going to spread its ideas. You're going to have Islamic revolutions elsewhere. You did not. In fact, when there was a Arab Spring, it had actually no connection with the Iranian Revolution of 79. And what you find is, although the politicians talk about anti-Zionism, anti-Americanism, anti-West, and so on in their discourse, when it comes to reality, the politicians, especially the presidents, are quite actually willing behind the scenes to work with United States. The problem has usually come from the United States, not from them. So it wasn't just Rouhani who wanted to make a deal with United States. Previous presidents had also worked with United States. We forget that when United States invaded the Taliban, and what's more, could be more Islamic than the Taliban in Afghanistan, Iran actually helped United States bring down the Taliban. Similarly, when United States invaded Iraq, Iran, in fact, helped United States. So at one time, in fact, Rafsanjani, who you could say is, you know, the ultimate type of a product of the Islamic Revolution of 79, he offered, you know, Boeing a multi-billion-dollar deal if the oil deals went. So he was quite happy to have good relations with the United States. Though polemically, he may have, you know, on Friday mosque sermons denounced United States. But behind the scenes, he was actually quite consistent about a more Machiavellian deal. The problem often was in the United States, and the U.S. couldn't get over the fact of the hostage crisis. And I think when Zarif talked about it's part of the, you know, the revolution, anti-Americanism, for him also it was a mistake to take the hostages, because from that it created this basically existential crisis between, from the U.S. point of view, in Iran. And of course, many politicians in Washington can't get over the fact that Iran is no longer led by the Shah and the good friend of the United States. So that leaves a bitter taste. So it's very hard for any politician, even someone like fairly reasonable president, to openly support a deal with Iran, because people are going to say, oh, you know, remember the hostage crisis, remember these guys are terrorists and so on. So I think that on the long run, we're minimizing the actual American problem in Iran-U.S. relations. It's easy to actually, I mean, the Islamic Republic is so despicable, as you can blame a lot of things on the Islamic Republic, but its foreign policy is not that irrational. And one can have actually a policy country whose internal policy is despicable, but its external policy is quite acceptable. I would say Stalin's policy internally was despicable, but his foreign policy was impeccable so from 1939, 33 to 39. Similarly, I think when we're actually blaming Iran for its foreign policy, we're forgetting the problems in Washington.
Professor Reinhard Adami, you had some thoughts.
Yes, I mean, briefly, to a couple of more examples along the lines of what Professor Abramyan was saying here. The one problem, of course, with Iran-U.S. relations is that it doesn't really go along faction lines very neatly. So if you look at the period in which Bush father was in charge, beginning of the 90s, that's when trade with Iran was really picking up, and that was when Rafsanjani was in power. And the start of the sort of process of sanctions and enmity on the American side with Iran starts in 94 with Clinton and the Helms-Damato Act and all that process. So actually there was a obviously the hypothetical moment, had George Bush father achieved a second term in office, we might have seen a different evolution of Iran-U.S. relations. And of course, he was a Republican. So the idea that Republicans are hard on Iran and Democrats are soft on Iran, I think, is not borne out by the facts if you look at them very closely. So it is a complex relationship from that point of view. The other thing that is important to note here is that the attitude towards the U.S. and the attitude towards Israel in Iran, I wouldn't call them necessarily ideological, but it is a sort of a legacy that has been transmitted on from Khomeini, and it has become part of the fabric, if you want, at least of an important element of the establishment. That I think these are two principles that Khomeini really took in an orthodox manner over from Khomeini when he became supreme leader. And of course, there are people in Iran who think that this is going too much. So, for example, you have voices who say that Iran's attitude towards Israel should be closer to Malaysia or Pakistan, other Islamic nations that are very strongly opposed to Israel, but have not turned it into a major national security issue as Iran has done, this sort of enmity. As Zarif, I think, is on record a few after the October 7 attacks, is saying that Iran has become more Palestinian than the Palestinians. And this is something that you hear every now and then within the corridors of power of or from former or current diplomats of the Islamic Republic, saying that Iran has really gone too far in its attitude towards Israel and in its confrontation towards Israel. But this has become as far, again, I don't see it necessarily as ideological. I see it more as again part of the experience and part of the sort of worldview which developed, which sort of gelled during Khomeini's time, which has picked up by Khomeini and has persisted. And this is, of course, subject to some debate, but this is more or less what the broad contours of the Islamic Republic attitude towards this. And again, you hear some dissenting voices in the people who are now running for office again, and that they admit that, to get past sanctions and to get past the current crisis that Iran faces, there needs to be some form of a rethinking in terms of foreign policy.
Sego Kar, we have about 2 minutes left. I'm going to give you the last word on this.
Yes, thank you. I usually use the theological mindset to explain the Islamic Republic domestic and foreign policies. When we talk about the ideology, we always think that this is a very locked down group of the set of the idea that you believe it, you believe to all of it, or you reject it, you reject all of it. But when you talk about the mindset that give you this opportunity to maneuver over that. The second thing is exactly what I call the personality system. You know, I agree. Hashemi Rafsanjani, Rouhani, Khatami always wanted to have a relationship with America. They really don't believe to this anti-Americanism. But none of them matter. Why? Because the core of the Islamic Republic, Ayatollah Khamenei, this revolutionary guard, and the radical clergies who are have a grip over the power are believed to this set of this mindset, this theological mindset, that is based on the idea of the nafya sabil, that you know, the rejecting that the infidel or have a control over you, or they believe to the whole idea of the, you know, dividing, this is on the legal Sharia, dividing the war to the Dar al-Harb, you know, the house of war and the house of death. This mindset will give you some opportunities. Ayatollah Khamenei accepted this mindset and then gave it to the Zarif and said, okay, go and solve our problem. Even if you are the most genius, I don't know, politician, you cannot do anything about it because these are the box that you have to work inside of.
Our panel today has been Siavush Ranjbar Daimi. He is a lecturer in modern Middle East history, the School of History at the University of St. Andrews, the author of The Tudor Party in Iran and the Peasant Question, and The Quest for Authority, A History of the Presidency from Revolution to Rouhani. Saeed Golkar, Associate Professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. He's the author of Captive Society, The Bajiv Mobilization and Social Control in Post-Revolutionary Iran, and Personalization of Power in Iran, Regime Incompetency and Protests in Iran. Nayeri Tohidi is Professor Emerita in the Department of Gender and Women's Studies and Middle East and Islamic Studies at California State University, Northridge. She's the author of Women's Rights and Feminist Movements in Iran. And Irvand Abrahamian, who is Professor Emeritus at City University of New York. He's the author of A History of Modern Iran and Inventing the Axis of Evil, The Truth About North Korea, Iran, and Syria. Thank you all very much for sharing your time and your expertise on this very important issue.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producer is Ankina Agassian. Seth Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on at Scholar Circle or me at Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.
ممکن است تلاش ما سازد.